And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Derek Van Riper here with Keith Law. It is Friday, October 1st. We are entering the final weekend of the 2021 season. We still have possible Game 163 scenarios on tap, so we're not going to really unpack those. We're just going to enjoy them this weekend and see if we get bonus baseball on Monday. But Keith recently wrote up his choices for all the major awards, including some down-ballot options. We're going to dig into a lot of the down-ballot options, the players that had great seasons that we haven't been talking about all year long, right? We've talked about Shohei Ohtani versus Vlad Jr. for the AL MVP for most of the summer. And we've talked about all the candidates for the NL MVP award for most of the summer. But once you get down to the bottom half of those lists, you get to some more players who've had fantastic seasons. And I think we want to dig into what they did, how they did it, and what is likely to happen with those players going forward. So Keith, I wanted to start today with Nathan Eovaldi because he made the list down ballot for AL MVP. He had him ninth in the piece. People should check it out over at The Athletic. But he was also on the AL Cy Young award list as well, understandably so. And Eovaldi has really, I think, gone on to exceed my expectations, maybe in a way similar to what Charlie Morton has done over the course of his career. Injuries were a big part of the story. You know, earlier in his career, it was a big velo fastball that was probably just too flat. And he's a lot more dynamic now than he used to be. And I'm starting to believe in Eovaldi as a legitimate, if not consistent, like top 10 MLB starter, a guy that will continue to churn out seasons that are more like in that top 25 range, which is very valuable.
And he is, right, he's a two-time Tommy John guy, I believe, which, if I'm right about that, I know he's had two major elbow surgeries. I think they were both the ligament replacement surgery, which is specifically what we call Tommy John. That would make him one of the only starters to be a two-time Tommy John guy. And even more interesting, a guy who is peaking after the second one. I'm not saying the surgery made him peak. Please don't go out and get two Tommy John surgeries just for kicks because you think it'll make you throw harder. But he has also really reinvented himself as a pitcher, I would say multiple times, since he was originally a prospect with the Dodgers, going way back. And he was just an arm strength guy. He made my top 100 prospects towards the back end one time. I don't know, still at ESPN, when he was a Dodger. And it was basically, this guy throws really hard. He misses some bats already. And how could you throw that hard and not eventually have like a decent slider to go with it? And as you said, the fastball was too flat, too straight. It was velocity uber alles, right? Nothing else matters. I'm just going to throw as hard as I can. And he struggled. And multiple teams took shots at him to try to, you know, the Rays in particular, we can, you know, if there's raw materials here, we can help him improve himself. I think he got a little bit better at multiple different stops. It is just now that it's all come together and he is a far, far more complete pitcher where not only is he able to miss more bats, including with the fastball, but he's not walking as many guys. He's not giving up as many home runs. And to the extent that that sticks around, especially makes him especially interesting because if you've got a, I don't care how hard you throw, if you've got a pretty flat fastball, you're going to give up home runs. That's the way the ball works right now. And I happen to believe that the baseball is just different than it was a couple years ago, but that's our reality. Whatever the cause is, if your fastball is pretty hittable, as Eovaldi's used to be, then you're going to be a high home run guy. And that's going to make you much less effective as a starter. And it looks like, you know, we'll see how as does he continue this into next year. But so far, it looks like he's solved what looked like it would have been a pretty significant problem to make him, I think at one point I comped him to Edwin Jackson. This is a guy everyone's going to want to take a shot at because he throws so hard and it's easy. And I can fix him. Well, this time it worked. Edwin Jackson is still the same guy, was still the same basically for his entire career. He was the same guy. Give Eovaldi credit. he has changed himself. He's improved himself to become this kind of starter, as opposed to a 15-year career of untapped potential.
By the way, I thought Edwin Jackson was going to get the coverall. I thought he was going to play it for all 30 teams.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Got about halfway there.
A shot, right? Yeah.
Impressive.
Yeah, he could probably set the. Does he have the record? Did he tie Mike Morgan? He might have beaten the record.
At least of players that I've been around for as an adult, he has the record. And that's as far back as I need to go with a record like that. But I want to stay with the other pitchers that have surprised us, the other AL Cy Young candidates. I mean, you had Gerrit Cole as your winner in the piece. I think that's a fairly common takeaway. But Robbie Ray has had a great season, too. And he's done some things that, I mean, I never thought Robbie Ray was going to be the kind of guy that had good control. I thought maybe passable control was a possibility if everything clicked. But he walked 17.9% of the batters he faced in the shortened season. He ran a double-digit walk percentage in three straight full seasons in 2017 to 2019. And he comes out this year, keeps the Ks, and slashes the walk rate to a career-best 6.7%. I mean, he's 244 Ks in 188 innings. This is typical Robbie Ray in that regard, but unlike anything else we've ever seen from him in his career here in his age 29 season. I think the question everybody has is, what's next for him? He's a free agent this offseason, and he's going to get a much larger contract than any of us ever would have predicted.
Yeah, it's like the Blue Jays traded for Robbie Ray, and then this winter sent him home and got Ronnie Ray instead. It's his secret twin brother. Robbie Ray looked like he was going to turn into a serviceable back-end starter for a while. He'd miss a lot of at-bats. I think he was a breakout candidate I had one year, and he ended up leading the NL in strikeouts. But there was also, he walked too many guys, and he was very inefficient. And so it looked like that's probably what he was going to be. And then the control kept getting worse. It looked like he was going to basically walk himself out of baseball. And I've been trying to think, of a guy who's had this dramatic a turnaround. Granted, it was the short season last year. He was awful, right? He was just unusable. I mean, people will probably go back to the Roy Halladay example, where Halladay had the worst 40-inning pitch season ever and got sent down to A-ball to redo his entire delivery. But he was a kid. He was still a prospect at that point, or just barely had lost prospect status. Ray is an established big leaguer who went from 30 control or worse. I mean, I think the only way is worse is if you're like, you got the yips, right? You're Jason Nabergall and everything's to the backstop. And Ray went from that to above average control. Who does that, right? What other examples do we have? We've had guys improve their control and improve their command. We actually expect guys to improve their command as they get into their mid to late 20s with experience, especially guys who are particularly athletic or have really good deliveries. But in Ray's case, it was not command. You couldn't even talk about command with Ray. How can you talk about command when he just walked the last three guys before you got the word command out of your mouth? Mm-hmm. So for him to turn around like this is, when writing about this, it was sort of, hey, if Ray wins, that's a great story. If he ends up getting the AL Cy Young Award, it's a really great story. I wouldn't vote for him first. He would be on my ballot for sure. But I would not also be upset to see him win because what an awesome story. I'm a fan of that. I'm a fan of guys who go out and just massively improve themselves like that. And to your point, would you want to run the risk of walking away from a guy as good as Robbie Ray was this year, who's basically number one starter? Because, yeah, it might be a fluke. It's entirely possible that it's a fluke and he's going to go back to walking the park next year. But you can't dismiss 180-something innings and just assume it's fluke. You just completely assume it's one, right? Especially we have better data now, and teams have even better data than we have they can look and say, I haven't heard anybody say that it's a fluke. It doesn't look like it's a fluke. The stuff is good. The location is good. The delivery is good. He's checking all the boxes. Don't you have to assume it's more likely that he'll continue for it? You can't assume he's going to stay this way, but you can assume there's a good chance he stays this way, because that's probably a better way to phrase it. In which case, what are you offering him? 3-4 year deal? Probably looking for five.
Yeah.
I would go out there and look for five and, actually be happy, very happy with four.
Yeah. Four for 80, four for 90 might be a possibility for Robbie Ray.
Oh, I would absolutely be looking for 20 plus. Look, if he pitches like he pitched this year, he's a $30 million guy.
Right.
A year.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in my mind, there's a couple things that I think about with Robbie Ray. 188 innings this season, that's enough of a statistical sample to believe that he does, in fact, own the skill. It's that old track record that everyone's worried about. But even if you think about it more in terms of the way like a Marcel projection works, where the most recent season is about half the weight of that projection. I think it goes 50% on the previous season, 30% on the year before that, and 20% 2 years ago. Then even in that sort of mindset, if you're trying to regress him to something like normal, he'd still be like an 8-9% walk rate guy. And that's better than he was before, especially with all the bats that he misses. So if he's a 3.75 ERA, 1.20 whip guy over a 4-year deal with a boatload of strikeouts, it's a lot like expectations for Eovaldi. You're happy with that at that price. Those are hard pitchers to find. So this transformation really is amazing, and I'd be on board with a team giving him a deal like that. I wouldn't be mad if my favorite team gave him a contract like that. I wouldn't be upset. That's speaking in generalities. My favorite team has a lot of pitching and shouldn't allocate resources that way, but that's not the point.
What, by the way, can we talk about, so the Blue Jays at the end of the trade deadline last year picked up Ray for basically nothing, picked up Taijuan Walker, who's had a perfectly serviceable season for the Mets this year. It's certainly the best season Walker has had since the injuries started. What is that? I think I saw it was his highest innings pitch total since 2016. And so they picked him up, and then they give the 1-year deal to Marcus Semien, who's obviously very high on my MVP ballot. Like, hey, if you're a Jays fan, and I know a lot of people have been dragging that front office since they took over from Anthopoulos, but how can you argue with some of the moves they've made, in total of the moves they've made in the last 13 months? That's a pretty good run of identifying players who got better after the Blue Jays acquired them.
Absolutely. And when you find those players at reasonably low cost or very low cost, that's a great skill to have as an organization. Mm-hmm. And they're obviously spending up at the top. They've got the higher end prospects coming through kind of as a group right now. Everything seems to be clicking in Toronto. And it's part of why that AL East is about as nasty as it's been in the last decade or so, because it runs a clear four teams deep for the foreseeable future. I was just digging through. There's a great page at Fangraphs. I don't know if people even realize this exists, but if you go to Fangraphs and you go to the leaders tab, there's a season stat grid, and you can look at year-to-year changes in any stat you want. And I was trying to see, like, is there anybody who's improved walk rate as much as Robbie Ray has improved from last year to this year? The closest I could find, going all the way back to 2006, was Aroldis Chapman from 2011 to 2012, made a massive step forward, 11.5% improvement in walk rate. Craig Kimbrel, a few years after that, had a big improvement. But a lot of times you see guys looking at the multi-year view of this, they'll go up for a year and they'll come back down. It's like the regression back to the mean. It's just kind of both sides of their range of outcomes. So it's incredibly rare to see that. I think the leader last season was Framber Valdez. He was the pitcher who had the most improved walk rate with a minimum of 50 innings pitched. But that page is awesome. It's one of those things that's been on Fangraphs for a long time, and somebody finally tipped me off to it this year. And I was like, I could waste
a day. Yeah, you gotta send me that on Slack.
Yeah, I'll pass that one along. But I could waste a week on that page just looking at stuff and like, how does this work? How do these trends change over time? The last pitcher that I thought we should talk about from the batch that you wrote about for the AL Cy Young is Carlos Rodon. And I think the where do we go from here question is really just a health question. The stuff is kind of like peak Rodon stuff, right? It's the same fastball, slider, changeup that we saw early in his career. The velo came back, but I have a lot of doubts about his ability to hold up and stay healthy over a full season in 2022.
Yeah, and he wasn't good in his most recent outing. It wasn't as good. His stuff was down. Credit to, I think it was Craig Calcaterra pointed that out in his newsletter. The velocity wasn't where you want it to be, and that would suck, right? That would just be a horrible shame for Rodon to come all the way back, be as good as he's been, and then to break down again. And if you're the White Sox now, you're coasting into the postseason. This was probably just a tune-up start. Obviously, they'll get some extra time off, but do you try to plan your playoff rotation in a way that Rodon doesn't pitch as much? That you're trying to, can't avoid him, probably, but maybe you can just maximize his days off and he's a fourth starter when you need one. You maybe try to push him back anytime there's a possibility, because I'm assuming there's nothing seriously wrong with him, that he's just wearing down from the longest season he's had in forever. But still, you've got to think, hey, we got a guy here who's got, you know, could have a whole career ahead of him as a number one, number two type starter. We have to treat him, handle him with kid gloves relative to the other three starters. They have three other really good, well above average starters in that rotation. So you could do that. You have the flexibility to do that with Rodon. And I don't have an answer. I'm just saying that is a conundrum for the front office right now. How much do we ride Rodon in this offseason, especially, you know, you don't have him forever, versus protecting a guy who's honestly, whose career looks like it's just starting, like his peak is probably just starting.
Yeah, I think it's a lot like the way the Nationals have had to manage Steven Strasburg. If you want to be optimistic mm-hmm. about how much they could get out of him in the future, high volume seasons for Strasburg are generally going to be more in that 150 to 175 range. I know he reached 200 innings twice, but especially at this stage of his career, I don't think we're getting back anywhere close to that from him in the future. So if you lower the expectations on Rodon long term, I think you can end up a lot happier with what you end up getting. I think in the playoffs especially, the solution might be to do something like use Rodon, go through the lineup once. If the velo dips, let him keep facing hitters. As soon as you see some signs of trouble, you bring in Michael Kopech, and you get a lefty-righty tandem option that maybe combined, you can get 6 or 7 innings from those guys every fourth game in the postseason. Right. That, to me, seems like maybe the best way to get around it without overtaxing Rodon from a health perspective.
Right. Rodon's a free agent after this season. I think I read that correctly. So that... I just looked it up to make sure I had it right because I couldn't remember if he had one more year, but that makes this decision, by the way, even worse. Like the incentive for the White Sox is to say, just use him, right? If he breaks down for the next team, so what? I mean, you could actually use him with the full intention of not trying to re-sign him. I am not advocating that. I think there's a pretty big ethical problem with that. However, you could do that. You could say, we're trying to win. And the best way to win is to pitch Carlos Rodon as much as we can in the postseason, because there will be plenty of games where he's the best option. I would rather have him start. Would rather have healthy Carlos Rodon start a game than Dylan Cease in the playoffs. Which is not to slag Cease necessarily, but just to say that Rodon is a better option. And so, do you use him more as a result? Figuring he's probably gone after the season, we'll go replace him. We go replace him with somebody else.
Yeah, I think that's really unfortunate too that he's not in a position to have that long term deal already in place. And I think if we had a comeback player of the year award that we were going to throw out there for the podcast, he'd probably win it.
Yeah. God, I'm sure I'm forgetting somebody just because it's not one I think about very much, but it's a pretty big comeback, right? From injuries that look like they would derail his career. I guess there's probably like a hierarchy in comeback players of the year, right? Like the guy who comes back from cancer or life-threatening illness first, guy who comes back from career-threatening injuries second, maybe?
Yeah. I think that's generally our minds tend to work. I mean, Eduardo Rodriguez, I think he could be a candidate for something like that. A very scary situation for him with myocarditis. Didn't pitch in 2020. But I think Rodon is someone that I think threw about 42 and a third innings in the previous two seasons combined, got non-tendered, came back with minimal expectations to get what he provided for the White Sox. That's comeback player of the year worthy for sure. If I had a vote on such a matter.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Let's go to the NL side here for just a moment. We talked a ton about these guys because this group has been back and forth all season. You know, Wheeler, Burns, Scherzer, Buehler. Brandon Woodruff seems like the guy people don't talk about. And then going one step further than that, I mean, the list only has 5 people on it. But Freddie Peralta, like, talk about players that I in my wildest dreams, could not have imagined a season like the one that he has turned in. He was in the bullpen last year, showed flashes from really day one as a big leaguer of being a guy that could be a good, maybe like mid-rotation guy with strikeouts. That was probably the ceiling expectation for Freddy Peralta. He's got an ERA under 3, a whip under 1, 195 Ks and 144 in a third innings. The main reason they've been careful with the workload is because of how little he threw a year ago. What is next for him? I mean, because he's part of a big three in Milwaukee that's a huge part. If the Brewers are able to win the World Series this year, it's probably because of contributions they're getting from Peralta in addition to Corbin Burns and Brandon Woodruff atop that rotation.
Yeah, well, Burns and Woodruff were like the known quantities, right? They were they've been maybe better than we expected, but we expected them to be good. Both guys were top 100 prospects for me in the past. But Peralta, until this year, was basically a one-pitch guy, right? It was all fastballs, and his four-seamer is not especially hard, but it missed bats up in the zone. It had great secondary characteristics. It had a pretty good spin rate for a four-seamer. He located it well up in the zone, and he could miss some bats with that. So I always went, honestly, I went back and forth with him. I was like, okay, well, that's really good. But if that's what you're throwing three quarters of the time, you don't really have a good secondary pitch. How are you a starter? Well, this year, he's added a slider. He's used his curveball less, and his slider that basically came out of nowhere, and it turns out has been extremely effective. Okay. Now you can be a starter. You have passed the starter test, the first starter test, which is you need a second pitch. Often I would argue you need a third pitch, but I won't quibble once you have a second pitch and both your fastball and that second pitch and the slider are as effective as they've been. And he's always been a strike thrower. That's not really an issue. And to his credit, despite throwing a lot of four seamers up in the zone, he's not been homer prone this year. So there are little things I would like to see him improve going forward. For example, he has a changeup. He really doesn't use it very much, but he's still using that more than he did in the past. Also, he's using his four-seamer less than he ever has before, and that's probably good. You know, just man cannot live on fastball alone. That's just not really like, – it's very, very few starters can do that. I feel like Bartolo Colon maybe did that for a while, and even then he would go – like when he was young and he was throwing, you know, upper 90s. I remember seeing him – in person when it was basically all four and two seamers. But he was a unicorn, right? Very, very few guys can do that, even if you throw especially hard. And so for Peralta to add, you know, now he's got the one clear out pitch among secondaries. Could he throw the changeup more? Could he be more effective than it is? Maybe it's not good enough for him to throw it more. But that's the one thing I would look at and say, all right, this may be, now that the slider is there, the next gating factor that determines what his ceiling actually is might be that instead, rather than, hey, he's already got a breaking ball. Like, he still throws the curveball sometimes. It's been effective. It's probably going to be more effective the less he throws it, and that's great. That's fine. I would like to see another pitch there to help him improve against lefties. And he does throw the changeup very, very, almost exclusively to lefties. So the idea is there. He and the Brewers have the right philosophy for how to use his arsenal. I would like to see how that pitch develops, because maybe he's a two. Maybe he's better than that. And I wonder if that third pitch will be the thing that determines it.
Yeah, having a breakout like that while throwing the fastball so much less is the amazing underlying part of the Freddy Peralta experience. And I think it is really encouraging that he has that changeup at least working against lefties, as you said. That's a key weapon for him. Probably keeps that home run rate more in check too. Let's get to some of the down ballot MVP candidates that you wrote up or at least put on your list. And one that no one talks about is Brian Reynolds in Pittsburgh, because, well, he's in Pittsburgh, and that's just unfortunate for him right now because he's a really good player. Yeah. You know, my thought coming out of 2019, that rookie season, was this is nice, but there's not another level here. This is what he is. He's a good everyday sort of player. And, you know, for a second division team, probably hits higher in the lineup than he should and maybe makes a few all-star games, but that's all we're going to get from Brian Reynolds. Well, no, that's probably wrong, because he's popped a 5-WAR season, and he's really improved in a lot of ways too. Lowest K rate we've seen from him so far as a big leaguer, career best walk rate, and more power than I expected too. So, you know, what's next for Brian Reynolds? He's under control for a long time. He's going to be a Pirate for the foreseeable future, unless they could see him as someone that brings back a lot more young talent. You know, what's the next move if you're Ben Charrington?
Yeah, I would trade him. I would absolutely trade him. Supposedly they discussed trading him at least to Atlanta at the trade deadline this year, and I would 100% look at how much I could get for trading him more because of the state of the club, right? This club is not, Pittsburgh is not contending soon. They're probably not contending in the next, certainly not contending in the next 2 years. And, you know, not that Reynolds is still only 26. If you kept him right up through free agency, you'd basically get all his peak years. But there's so much value in a player as good as he is, who still has, what does he have, 3 years of club control remaining? That's worth a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can convert that value that is still there because of Reynolds' contract status as well as the player that he is into adding multiple younger pieces, you take on some extra risk, but you set up the timing a little bit better because I think the Pirates farm system is good. I think the Major League Club is not good. I also think there are some players on the Major League Club who should be better. And now that they're making some changes to parts of the big league coaching staff, we may see that. But I can't imagine them being a good enough team while Brian Reynolds is in the uniform there that for them to be better off keeping him than taking the best offer they can for him. And maybe that's this offseason. Maybe you got it this winter when, you know, I always say that but when you've got a big player to trade, I believe it's better to try to do it in the offseason because everyone bids, or almost everyone bids. Everyone thinks they're contending and teams have budget left. Whereas in the middle of the season, a lot of teams don't want to add payroll and a lot of teams that thought they were going to contend aren't contending. Minnesota went into last year, thought they were contending, turned out they weren't contending. There's just a lot more belief, hey, we can win this year. So I would absolutely put Reynolds out there. You don't have to trade him because of the contract status, but I would certainly try to put him out there and see what I could get for him. And I will say too, you know, Reynolds to me, he was a second round pick of the Giants. I remember talking to some people with the Giants and they took him too. I'd ranked him as a first rounder because I'm like, there's power in there. We're just not seeing it yet because he was a very passive hitter in college. He ran lots of deep counts. He was comfortable running deep counts, but it also led to a lot of pitcher's pitches that he would either just not swing at, strike out, or put into play and not put into play the way that obviously you'd want a hitter with his kind of potential impact to put into play. I think he's become more aggressive without giving up his walks, but he's hunting better pitches earlier in the count. And it looks like the Pirates have done enough to improve his swing to get a little more loft in it. They haven't overhauled it, but it's definitely a little more optimized for launch angle. And I think that's probably why we're seeing more of the power.
Yeah, it's the lowest ground ball rate of his career. So every time you see that number tracking down, yeah, the ball's in the air. It's either a fly ball or a line drive. So that certainly helps when you're tapping
like
that
those.
Power. Yeah, that's always,
those are good.
It's always a trend I'm looking for when we see increased power. Did you get rid of some ground balls? Oh, good.
Yeah.
Maybe you can hold some of that power. If you're looking at Reynolds, how long can he stay in center field? That's where the Pirates play him. Are you trading for him to play him in center field, or are you just kind of using him there if you have to and planning on playing him in a corner?
You know, outs above average loves him in center. And that's, to me, the best of the public defensive metrics. I'm surprised. I always thought I thought he might stay in center. I never, ever thought he'd be this good in center. Absolutely not. Despite the fact he could run a bit and he was athletic, I would bet if you looked at everything I ever wrote about Brian Reynolds, I never said he'd be a plus defender in center. But he was this year. So, I mean, as long as at the end of the day, when I'm looking at a player, even if I think it maybe doesn't look that pretty, but if outs above average, which is based right off the Statcast data, has him this far, he's 10 runs above average in center this year, and he played a little bit in left also. They've got him that good in center. My God, just leave him there. So I would trade for him as a center fielder. Unless I had, you know, an elite guy out there, right? If you have a 70 defender in center, fine. You put Reynolds in a corner, and he maybe has like a Brett Gardner-type defensive impact playing in a corner instead. But hell, I would, if I'm Charrington, I'm marketing him as a center fielder. Hey, I got a center fielder with power and on base skills. Why not?
Yeah. Plenty of teams could use Brian Reynolds, and it would be smart for the Pirates to make that move given their needs and their timetable to be a playoff caliber team again. Staying in the NL Central, you know, who's had a great season and it's part of the Cardinals 17 game win streak, which did come to an end on Wednesday, Paul Goldschmidt. He's kind of turning in a vintage Paul Goldschmidt season. I think the only number that doesn't kind of hold up to peak Goldschmidt, the OBP is a little lower these days, 367 instead of 400 plus, but everything's there. Even that little bit of speed too, a dozen bags on top of the 31 homers he's popped. He's probably going to finish with over 100 runs and over 100 RBIs. Again, he's done that a handful of times in his career too. What is it about Goldschmidt that leads people to keep kind of underrating and discounting him?
I mean, it's always pretty quiet right? He's a quiet sort of MVP. I mean, both quiet as a person, but also maybe it's because part one of the reasons I didn't rate him highly at all as a prospect, too, is if you look at the swing, you look at his home runs, a lot of line drives. It's not the big flies. He's not a highlight generator. So much of what he does well is not flashy. It is not exciting, you know, unless you're a Cardinals fan. Obviously, it's exciting if he's helping you win. But they're not automatically highlight plays. He's a good defender at first base. First base defense, generally not that sexy. He's a really, really smart base runner, but he's not a burner. So I wonder if it's just that we don't see him as much because of that. And yet then you look at the end of the season, it's like, hey, Paul Goldschmidt was one of the 10 best players in the National League. How'd I miss that? And maybe that's why. I mean, I would guess, all right, this I'm making this up, and if somebody wants to verify or dispute this, feel free. But maybe have more highlights like Tyler O'Neill, who's nowhere near the hitter that Goldschmidt is, but Tyler O'Neill is a weightlifter playing baseball. And so when Tyler O'Neill gets a hold of one, it's a pretty big fly ball. And Goldschmidt just doesn't hit him like that. And again, that's part of why I underrated him, because I saw that swing and I saw the power he had, and that's not going to be a 30 home run type bat. It's not, you know, there's nothing it's not electric bat speed. He doesn't have that kind of loft in his finish. But it turns out he's so strong, he hits the ball so hard that even if the line drive is maybe not, if the launch angle is not exactly what you'd expect for big home runs, he hits it on the screws really, really often. And that's where the power comes from. It's just not, I was just going to say, it's not the kind that shows up on SportsCenter. Does SportsCenter show baseball anymore? Do people still watch SportsCenter?
I haven't watched it in a long time. You know, I like the SVP version of SportsCenter once in a while, mm-hmm. but that's about it.
If I'm, you know, when I see SportsCenter in airports, I'm walking by an airport, I'm like, oh, hey, I used to work for them. I don't actually say that. That'd be horrible.
Out loud.
I'm not that guy. Yeah. No, not I say it to myself.
You don't find the nearest person say, hey, I used to work there.
I worked there. Yeah. They'd be like, okay, if you see something, say something.
Strange man in the airport. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Delusions of grandeur.
Paul Goldschmidt, too, has that longer term extension that he signed with the Cardinals. It was 5 for $130. Yep. I think I probably chuckled out loud when it happened. And 2 years in, doesn't look like a horrible move. And it looks like a skill set that's going to age really gracefully. The eye's still good. There's a ton of red ink on his StatCast page, too. So it's not smoke and mirrors. It is a baseline that is probably much higher than many of us have been giving him credit for here for these last couple of years. So how do the Cardinals do it? Well, Paul Goldschmidt's a big part of it. Tyler O'Neill, who you mentioned, is a big part of it too. I think we talked about him last week, just reaching this level that I don't know if anybody could have expected that from Tyler O'Neill either.
No, and that's I'm taking the under on him next year. That's when I'm not buying it. I think the power is real. I don't think he's going to have the consistent contact, consistent good fortune on balls in play. I think it is, it's pull power. It's real power. But what goes with it? His play discipline is not very good. It's never been very good. It's not very good. He's having a great year. Good for them. Good for him. Good for them. Not a guy to invest in long term. Like, to me, you want the next 5 years of him or the next 5 years of Dylan Carlson? I'll take the next 5 years of Dylan Carlson. And I know that they sound strange because O'Neill just had the better season, but I like Carlson's skill set and growth potential. Whereas I think this is peak Tyler O'Neill right here.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they sort of switched value-wise, where if O'Neill went back to being more like a 2-win player next year and Carlson popped as like a 4-to-5-win guy, I think that'd be a story I could buy into based on expectations for those two players.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. You don't get that many opportunities to upgrade your organization through a terrific hire. LinkedIn Jobs helps you to nail those chances. We've all searched for a job at some point in our lives, and chances are, if you're like me, you've used LinkedIn as a resource to network and follow the trends in your industry. You've spent a lot of time on LinkedIn, so why wouldn't you make that the place to post your job? LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to a perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, You're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. LinkedIn knows that small businesses are wearing so many hats and might not have the time or resources to hire. LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make that process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/MLB show. That's linkedin.com/MLB show to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
I do think Jonathan India, who you have as your selection for the NL Rookie of the Year, is worth talking about again. We've talked about him a little earlier in the season because it was injuries in the minor leagues that really stunted that power. But I think the question I have for you that I didn't throw out there before is, what's next for him? Is there one more level there? Is he going to be a guy that is among the best second basemen in the league for the next, you know, 3 to possibly 5 years? Because he does a lot of things very well.
Yeah, that's a great question. Because he's 24, right? You think 24-year-old, there's probably another level there. But where is he? Where does he improve from here? 33 doubles and 21 homers. Could some more of those doubles become homers as he gets a little older? Yeah. Do I feel like he's a 30-plus homer guy? All right, ignoring the fact he plays in Cincinnati, which does lower the bar for home runs a little bit. But I don't think it's that kind of guy. Like, I think he's a high doubles guy. I would feel more comfortable predicting that he gets to 45 doubles at some point than 30 home runs, which is still good, right? Just different sorts of players. And, hey, he already walks a ton. And he got hit. He's leading the NL in times hit by pitches with 22. Could he become a 320 average kind of hitter? That's probably the one path he has to becoming. He's like a 4-5 WAR player right now. To becoming more than that would mean either cutting the strikeout rate, which is not there's nothing wrong with it, but just putting more balls in play for more hits, or just becoming a higher BABIP guy going forward. That's probably the one path he has to becoming, you know, 5-6 WAR player, to becoming the best second baseman in the National League. I think it's possible. I would be more comfortable betting on Jonathan India plays the next 8 years and is pretty much this kind of player. Maybe 10% better, 5% better, but is pretty much this kind of player, which is obviously really good and great for him. I mentioned this in the piece too. He was 2019 was a disaster. He tried to play through a wrist injury and then doesn't get to show anybody what he can do when he's healthy in 2020. Good for the Reds for being willing to give him a shot so early this season when the previous minor league performance was not there. And he's got 148 games for them. He's basically been an everyday starter for a team that was trying to make the playoffs and they believed in what they saw last year. So I give them credit for willing to take on that risk.
Picking nits just for a moment, I think the one thing in his profile that gives me just a little bit of pause is he's been really pull happy this year. I don't think that's who he'll be long term as a hitter, but I wonder if he goes to a more balanced all field sort of approach, if that caps the power and makes what he did from a home run perspective more of a ceiling than a repeated sort of expectation for him going forward. A 51.3% pull percentage is big time.
Yep. Yes, it is. I wonder to what extent the ballpark does that to guys in Cincinnati, because it is, right? If you have some pull power. It can reward pull power more than a lot of other ballparks. And what doesn't worry me, though, is it hasn't made India a bad hitter overall, right? He's not completely unwilling to use the opposite field. Pitchers have not exploited him, and then suddenly he's striking out, you know, 30% of the time. If he were doing that, I'd be more concerned. You know, that said, if we're talking about just a player's abstract value, right, you want him, you know, not that they're trading him, but if he were somewhere else, would that same approach be as fruitful? Probably not.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It does pull it a little more at home than on the road, looking at the splits from this year. So yeah, maybe part of it is I'm rewarded for pulling the ball here. So I'm going to pull the ball here because I can. That's not necessarily a bad thing if you can maximize your environment that way. A few of the AL MVP candidates that haven't received a ton of attention, maybe one a little more recently who has because he's reached that 30-30 milestone, is Cedric Mullins. And I think we talked about him maybe a month or so ago briefly, just kind of saying, is he on the next Orioles playoff team? Because they have the same sort of issue with Cedric Mullins in Baltimore that the Pirates probably have with Brian Reynolds, where you look at him and say, yeah, he's great, but maybe we need to trade him because we still need so much more in the long run. And I guess you could maybe talk yourself into some of the Orioles core being a little closer. I think we talked about that system recently as well. What do you think Mullins actually provides in 2022? Because this is one of the biggest surprises of the season.
Yeah, it is a huge surprise. There's nothing in his previous career to indicate that this was coming. I mean, there's just absolutely nothing. Not that he never had tools. I knew guys who were there when they drafted him way back in 2015. And he was sort of a prospect, but he's an extra outfielder. He's a great kid. He really plays hard. There's a good, you know, he can run some. But he's got 30 home runs this year. He had 7 coming into this year. He never hit more than 14. I'm cheating. I'm looking at his Fangraphs page. He never had more than 14 home runs in any single season. The most home runs he had in 2 consecutive seasons was 27. And he has 30 this year, although that's a partial season, so that's kind of like not really quite apples to apples. Still, he never had anything close to indicating he would develop 30 homer power down the road. And this isolated power is by far the highest he's ever posted in any spot, any single stop, anywhere in his career. And it's not like he had some extreme batting average on balls in play that you know where that's a total fluke. He's walking more. He's striking out a bit less. He just completely changed himself, changed everything about himself as a hitter. Yeah, I want to say there's going to be some regression next year because there just usually is, right? They're just usually when a guy jumps from, he had a negative career WAR coming into this year, and he's at, I'm looking at Fangraphs, Baseball Reference, maybe slightly different, but he went from negative 0.4 or negative 0.3 WAR coming into this year. He's got 5.6 WAR just this year. So odds are he's not going to have 5.6 WAR again next year. But I would still bet on him being an above average regular. I'm not saying I think he's going to drop to being even a 2 WAR guy. Like, I think he's still probably an all-star next year. Just maybe he's not a 30-30 guy. Maybe just some little bits of, you know, even if he wasn't exceptionally lucky this year, you know, some of the, you know, if he was a little bit lucky this year, he's a little bit less so next year, and there's what looks like regression, even though he's actually the same player. I just don't see fault here. There's no, you know, just because we're sort of trying to pick apart certain guys, is this repeatable, is this repeatable, is this repeatable? Of a lot of these guys, to me, Mullins is in the Austin Riley category. Now, that's real. That's probably who he's going to be. It's just that in Mullins' case, I just see no room for further improvement, so it's more than likely he'll give back a little bit. And maybe he's, you know, he's probably going to end up close to 6 WAR this year. Okay, maybe he's at 4.7 or so next year. And who cares? That's still a great season.
And I think this is one of the more challenging things about projecting performance is when you have a player who stays healthy for a full season, I don't think you can even project the same volume of playing time for a guy like Mullins the following year. I know Marcus Semien ran into this a couple of years ago, and everyone said, well, there's no way he could do this again. Well, he did it again, so we're all wrong for that take. But usually, maxing out your playing time requires even avoiding like day-to-day, you know, soft tissue injuries that don't put you on the IL. And everything seems like it has gone right for Mullins. Now, the shape of his future seasons could be 18 homers and 40 steals. Like, that could happen too. Like, you could get more speed, less power in a few instances. he does pull pretty much everything power-wise, but he's also not switch hitting for the first time in his career. And that's such a that's such a massive thing that I think I overlooked back in February. If you think about a player that has switch hit for, let's say, 8 or 10 years, ever since high school, and they give that up, does that give you this path to not always take a leap as much as Mullins, but is it the kind of thing that can be overlooked by just the broader community of baseball analysts? Because I certainly overlooked it in this case.
Well, because we just don't have a ton of data on guys like that, right? There aren't that many guys who drop switch hitting in the majors, who switch hit for a little while in the majors and then give it up. Remember JT Snow, I think, did that eventually because he was so bad from one side. But usually those guys stop in the minors, and we have just as many examples of, oh, we're trying to make so-and-so a switch hitter. And sometimes that just makes me, obviously listeners can't see, but I'm doing the Captain Picard face palm as best I can. Like, I think that's ruined a lot of guys or hurt a lot of guys, you know, often because it's, well, we want to have him hit from the left side so he can make better use of his speed. And sometimes there are valid reasons to try to encourage guys to switch hit. Nothing is one size fits all here. But I don't know of many examples of major league players. Mullins wasn't established, but he was no longer a rookie at least, who then gave up switch hitting. Maybe we should remember him. I think that's what I'm coming around to saying here is, hey, keep this in mind. When you see somebody else stop switch hitting, should we pay more attention to that? Should that be a bigger news item, prospect or big leaguer for that matter? Hey, watch this guy. See what happens. Now you want to watch what happens to his platoon splits to make sure he doesn't lose ground there, but maybe it just wasn't working, and maybe things are a lot easier for him going forward.
Yeah, I just think because if you had that approach and it wasn't working, the overall numbers don't pop, you don't get as excited about that player, and here you go. Now you got a guy that only has to focus on one swing. He can actually make more adjustments a lot more quickly because he's not doing twice the work to prepare. Like, I just think switch hitting is one of the hardest things to do in sports.
Yeah, now you got me wondering, too. There was a prospect recently who gave up switch hitting, and now I can't remember who it is. Oh my God. Of course I'm going to remember it as soon as we're done. But God, who was it? And it would, because I want to go check and see what happened, actually. That is platoon splits fair this year. I think the Mariners made Anderson Tejeda a switch hitter because he was just so atrocious versus lefties. It's like, you might as well not play. So he can't be worse hitting from the other side. But those are also kids, they're prospects. You can do there and more, it should be more flexible. It's not like trying to, you can do that a little bit easier, more easily at that point. Also, that was not a case of trying to take advantage of a guy's speed. It was because he's so bad against pitchers from one side. We have to find any kind of solution for that. But dropping switch hitting, I feel like we don't see that much for established. Maybe it just happens more in the low minors or happens before guys get into pro ball at all. Also, I just feel like we don't see that many switch hitters anymore at all, which is a whole separate issue. Although, you know, there's a part, old school part of me that's like, I reckon mighty, everybody could hit from three sides of the plate.
That's the voice you need to use when you tell people randomly at the airport that you used to work at ESPN.
I used to work for the worldwide leader in sports.
One last player we should talk about before we go. You mentioned a little earlier, Austin Riley. He's popped 32 home runs so far this year. I think the thing that's really stood out to me is that he's hit 302. And batting average isn't a thing that I care that much about, but I didn't think his profile was going to lead to a full major league season where he'd be at that level, even though there were some stops in the minor leagues. He hit 282 as a 21-year-old at AAA over 75 games. So maybe I should have took that as a little bit more of an indicator that it was possible. The plate discipline got a lot better last year in the shortened season, even though the slash line didn't take a step forward. That was the one thing that drew me to Riley back during the spring. But how sustainable is this output for Austin Riley going forward? Is he a regular fixture in the middle third of this great Atlanta lineup?
Yeah, I think he's a 5-WAR player going forward. And I talked to Austin and talked to some people with Atlanta, and I wrote a whole piece about him too, about how he just completely turned himself around. And you could, even if you go through some of the pitch data from last year too, he still had pretty clear weaknesses, and he just closed them. You just cannot beat this guy the way that there was a pretty clear book on Austin Riley coming out of 2019. it still mostly worked in 2020. And this year, you might as well just pulp that book because it is useless now. And he's just, he's laying off so many pitches that were just destroying him previously. And to me, he's a great model for lots of teams now to say, you know, you've got to be looking, if you're running player development for anybody, you have to look at your system and say, who do we have who could be our Austin Riley, right? Is there somebody we have who has fairly clear deficiencies in his approach at the plate that we can target? You probably have five of those guys, but who also like hit the ball really hard and have natural power. And in Riley's case, plays a position very well too, which also, you know, give Austin credit. He was not a good third baseman when he started in pro ball. He's become one. He is, what he's done, even though it's pretty rare, should be a template for other teams working with player development. Because you only need one, right? You take an Austin Riley, who is a replacement level player or below at the start of the season, and you have an all-star. That pays for a whole lot of effort. That pays for five coaches' salaries going forward. And I think because Riley's approach is so good, and he's very aware of it, talking to him, I don't talk to a lot of players too, because often it's not helpful and it just sort of makes me like the players as people. And then that's not good for my job, right? Because then I actually do get, feel like I'm maybe biased. And I like talking to Austin. He was a great kid. But he also recognizes, like, he can speak so clearly, so concretely about the changes he's made and things he needs, wants to still continue working on. When you find a player who's got that in addition to the physical ability that Riley has too, not only do I think he's going to stay as he is, I think he'll probably get better. I think there's probably still one more step up for him. And maybe that makes him a top five player in the National League at some point in the next couple of years. He's still young enough to get there.
Is there a player that you've seen here in 2021 who might be on a similar track to have a breakout like the one Riley just had in 2022?
Oh, God. Can I defer that question until, like, I don't know, March?
Fair.
Actually, if you want to know who's going to break out next year, look at guys that thought were going to break out this year, because I'm constantly 1 year behind on these guys. It's like, it's been ridiculous. It is. I mean, I say it as a joke, but readers have pointed this out. Like, I'm constantly a year early on guys, which I guess is good, better than, like, some guys just never do break out at all, obviously. And I'll miss on some of those guys. But at least some of these guys break out, like, eventually. So, God, who would I think of now? I mean, to be honest, I spend a lot of time doing the before that breakout column trying to dig into some of the batted ball data and plate discipline stuff to try to find some kind of evidence to justify maybe gut feelings on players. So, I don't know, maybe I'll think of a good name afterwards. I will say this. I mentioned Dylan Carlson. It's coming. I don't know what year. Maybe it's next year. He had a nice rookie year. He's going to be an all-star. I think that kid's going to be, he's going to get on base a ton. He's going to have plenty of power. I don't know when. And if I say next year, it's probably going to be a year after that.
Yeah.
But he's somebody I feel extremely strongly about. He's going to be very good.
Yeah, I think who's the next Austin Riley? It's an unfair question this early, but it's the kind of question.
Yeah, how dare you?
I spend most of November and December trying to solve that. That's like, I enjoy the playoffs in October, and then it's mm-hmm. more of, okay, now it's going to happen next. And by like November 16th, I'm sitting here 8 o'clock in the morning tweeting some stuff about some guy's plate discipline and how I think it's going to matter and it's going to lead to a breakout the following year. So November 16th, 8 a.m. Pacific time with a cup of coffee, I will share my thoughts on Twitter.
When?
In about 6 weeks.
I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah.
Are we still doing shows? Do we even know?
I don't know how often we're going in November. People were asking on Twitter, and I didn't mean to just not reply to friendly questions. We are doing shows in October each week. I think once we get to November, the schedule lightens up a little bit. We're on once or twice a month, and then it picks back up again sometime, probably around February. None of that is written in ink at this point, but that's the plan at the last time that I heard of the plan. So if you're enjoying this show, please take a moment to leave us a nice rating and review. We'd really appreciate it if you did that. New subscribers can get in for 50% off at theathletic.com/baseball show. Check out Keith's award column, everything else he's got going, plus tons of great baseball stories down the stretch. I think there's a Corey Brock piece looking at the Mariners. Are they good or are they lucky? Maybe it's a little bit of both. They have made things a bit more exciting in that AL wildcard race down the stretch. On Twitter, he is at Keith Law. I am at Derek Van Riper. The Athletic Baseball Show is back on Monday. Have a great weekend.